Main Engine Cutoff. I am Anthony Colangelo, and I'm very excited about today's show, where we'll be talking with Jared Isaacman of the Polaris program. You may remember Jared Isaacman as the commander of Inspiration 4. He is an entrepreneur, a couple different businesses, and then went on to buy that private space flight from SpaceX and fly Inspiration 4. After that, he has developed this thing called the Polaris program, which is, as I put it, it's a private Gemini program. They are in partnership with SpaceX, developing capabilities that SpaceX has not yet worked on as part of their human spaceflight portfolio. So first one they picked off, Polaris Dawn, that is the first of three missions as part of the Polaris program. Jared Isaacman will be flying along with Scott Poteet, who was involved with Inspiration 4, not on the crew, but involved with the program. And then two SpaceXers, Sarah Gillis and Anna Menon. They're going to be going up. They're going to be doing an EVA. They're going to be flying to about 1,400 kilometers of an apogee. They are picking off a bunch of different tasks that they need to achieve to push SpaceX's human spaceflight capability a little bit farther. I'm very interested to talk to Jared about the why behind this program. We're going to zoom out a little and talk about how it originally started, the way that they choose the things that they'll work on as part of the Polaris program, how they interact with SpaceX, how they develop the ideas behind this, what kinds of things that they're thinking about for the future, what kind of things that they thought about for this particular flight, and the way that those are, you know, special capabilities that they want to see in the future. We also talk a lot about the way that spaceflight needs to change for handling an increased load of human spaceflights. You know, if you project your head in the future, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, when there's tons of people flying to space, how does that change the things that we need to be able to do? How does it change the infrastructure we need? It's really interesting to dig into some of that and hear how he's trying to make the Polaris program contribute to that storyline of spaceflight. So very cool conversation. I'm excited for you to hear it. So without further ado, let's give Jared a call. All right, Jared, thank you so much for joining Main Engine Cutoff. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We were talking right before we started, but I want to give everyone else the context that on an upcoming episode, we'll talk with the whole Polaris Dawn crew, the other three, not the whole thing. We got one of them here. And on that one, we're going to talk about the mission itself, preparation, execution of it. But with you, I wanted to talk about some of the higher level stuff, the why behind Polaris program, because I find it quite interesting. And I feel like most media outlets get caught up on, you know, man buys space flights and does cool things. And I'm more interested in the way that you see this contributing to, you know, the story of spaceflight over time. So, you know, where we sit now, we're about a year after Inspiration 4. I'm curious to follow the story there about when the spark for the Polaris program, you know, did you have it on orbit when you were up there thinking about what else could be done? Or was it talking to the SpaceX team afterwards? When did that idea come about?
You know, I guess it goes to late summer prior to Inspiration 4's launch. So, you know, late summer 2021. And, you know, there were some very, very preliminary conversations with SpaceX about what comes next. And we, you know, we hit the pause button as soon as we started getting in anywhere near, you know, launch timeline, just to make sure focus was all in the proper place. And, you know, honestly, when we came back from Inspiration 4 and everything went so well and, you know, Elon came in with that, you know, last minute donation and put us well above our objective. I mean, basically everything we set out to accomplish on orbit and as part of the, you know, the bigger, you know, kind of objective of raising, you know, funds for St. Jude Children's Research Hospital was like, man, we really, you know, accomplish everything we set out to do. And, you know, the bar is really high. Maybe this is enough. And now, you know, we leave it for all the other exciting missions to follow was kind of the idea. But, you know, I was invited in October, a couple of weeks after we got back, to go to Starbase, again. And, you know, it was a conversation with, you know, some of SpaceX leadership and some of the mission directors from Inspiration 4. And Elon was there, and, you know, the idea of Polaris, you know, was really born, which was, hey, there are some really, you know, exciting things we can accomplish from, you know, a tech development perspective that will help, you know, the bigger picture of Starbase and opening up, you know, space for others and making life multiplanetary. And, you know, this seems like something that would be, you know, up your alley, and also, you know, will fit in really well with a continuation of our work with St. Jude. So, it was, like instantaneously appealing. Like it was like, yes, this is exactly the kind of thing that I would like to be able to contribute to. And, you know, it does kind of achieve, you know, that balance between making progress for the world of tomorrow while continuing our work for St. Jude today. So that's how it kind of all came to be. I'd say in October, most of the work was done after Inspiration 4.
It's really interesting to hear that, because it's not surprising if you dig into what you're trying to accomplish. But, you know, I find Polaris program so interesting because it is like we're getting to watch a private Gemini program in a lot of ways, where Gemini was a step between Mercury and Apollo, where we had figured out the basics, but we needed all these advanced things to actually go do Apollo, EVA and docking and rendezvous and living in space. And that's kind of the interaction you're having here with what SpaceX has been working on, where they had a baseline that they needed to hit for NASA for commercial crew missions, but they were never going to, you know, spend resources on some things that they didn't have a customer for, or they didn't have a reason to go fly and do these. Even the cupola on Inspiration 4 really was, you know, they weren't going to build that as a side thing to commercial crew because they didn't really have any reason to. So is that the methodology that you take with the capabilities that you choose to take on as part of Polaris program, that you're trying to look for things that SpaceX does not yet have a necessary need for, but needs to develop if you have this wider view of where they're going in the future?
Yeah, I think you characterize it incredibly well. Now, I mean, I don't put anything that we're endeavoring to do on the scale, you know, as, you know, the pioneers from, you know, Mercury and Gemini and, you know, not just the astronauts, but all the engineers and such that contributed. That, I mean, that was a massive effort. I mean, we benefit.
Yeah, I hope your budget is a little smaller than that.
we benefit so much from everything that has been achieved, you know, decades before us. But I think you actually have the idea really close to correct in that, you know, with Dragon, there's no real, you know, there's little to no incentive to invest, you know, to learn on that vehicle when you have a customer that has a very specific requirement of going from, you know, A to B to the space station, which means you have to do then a lot of your learning in Starship. But that's kind of way down the road. So, I mean, imagine how much, you know, progress we can make and what we can cut off the timeline if, you know, the EVA suit development, which would never have been contemplated with Dragon, can be accomplished now, or, you know, some of the thoughts about how to scale up Eclipse and avionics for Starship, can be tested in Dragon, like by going to, you know, near the Van Allen radiation belt, which you never would have gone for Dragon and wasn't initially part of its design purpose. And then, you know, when you start looking at things like contingency or emergency deorbits from much higher altitudes than was initially designed, the way you can account for that in a vehicle like Dragon can carry over, whether it's entry angles or otherwise, into you know, future vehicle design and such. So there is a lot that you can stand to gain, and no question SpaceX would have absolutely gotten to it anyway. It just could have been years down the road for when Starship is that platform to do all that dev in, you know, versus in Dragon. So I think this worked out really well in that we all know where we want to get to, which is Starship. I mean, that is going to be the game changer to really open up space for others, not just humans, but I mean, think of all the other applications, not just even satellites or cargo, but like, you know, new space telescopes or probes could all leverage this amazing prefab design, if you will. But before we get to that, there's a lot we can learn using one of the only, you know, crew rated, you know, proven vehicles in the world. And we should do that. And that's what Polaris endeavors to, you know, to accomplish.
Yeah. With excess capacity too, right? There's this headroom in Dragon that, you know, until you came along, it's going to be used a couple times a year for space station flights, for private astronaut missions to the space station. But, you know, they never really got off with Dragon Lab back in the day, where there was this idea to sell, you know, uncrewed Dragon flights that never really took on anything. And it was like, okay, well, let's see what comes along in the human spaceflight department. So it is cool to hear, you know, the way that meshes with what we know about SpaceX historically, where they try to be part of programs that are heading directionally the same way that they are, where they know they want to develop a certain capability, and that's close enough to what NASA's looking for, or what the Space Force is looking for, and or even commercial flight, right? They're doing commercial satellite launches, and then they're like, let's see if we could land these things after that part of the mission is done.
Right.
So they've always tried to find that way where they're going this direction. If you've got something that's sort of heading the same direction, we'll do it as well. So I guess, does that mean that anything that you're going to bring to the table needs to be in line with like Starship utility in the future? You might personally feel like that's what you want to take on anyway, but is that a kind of ground rule requirement from SpaceX side?
I would say like we're both like completely aligned on the point that it should all help us get to Mars. And that is very, very ingrained in the SpaceX on how they evaluate virtually everything. I would say that when we looked at what we wanted to accomplish on Polaris Dawn, what was in, you know, open for consideration for the second Polaris mission, were all meant to kind of, you know, either, you know, de-risk elements of Starship, accelerate certain components of that program. And that's why it ultimately concludes with the first flight of Starship. I think that that's pretty fair. The program has to generally support progress being made to get humans to Mars.
Now, I'm curious to dig into the SpaceX partnership, the way they look at it. I guess really like timeline wise, right? They have, Sarah and Anna are from the SpaceX team. They're flying on Polaris Dawn. Do they see that as, did that come about because of the specific requirements around Polaris Dawn? Or is that something that's going to carry through on the other two flights as well and elsewhere in the program?
No, I mean, not. I think the, you know, you build the crew around the objectives. I had a pretty good idea of who I was going to, you know, look to go to on a crew coming off of Inspiration 4. You know, Sarah and Anna both played big roles in it, as did a lot of others. The ultimate, you know, kind of how we arrived at a selection process was very joint with SpaceX, because Polaris is kind of a joint program there. But you build a crew around the objectives. If there is a, you know, or when there is a second mission, its requirements could, you know, necessitate a crew that's outside of SpaceX, and that's fine too.
My dream shot for the second mission was that you were going to do the polar inclination corridor for Dragon. I had a whole theory about how now that they got these polar flights out of Cape Canaveral, you can abort zones is what you're worried about, right? So you can't really, you don't have a lot of abort zones outside of the corridor that we're all using to get to, you know, the same inclination that you've done for Inspiration 4. I'm like, man, I'm looking at this map and it looks like the east coast of Florida and the west coast of South America is a pretty good line.
You know, it's interesting you bring up, well, first of all, I
thought that's what the name was. I was like, Polaris, they're doing it. They're going polar.
Yeah, I mean, not to crush your hopes there on that, but of the two high probability second missions that we knew of internally when we announced Polaris, neither were a polar orbit. I think people have a pretty good idea of what one of them is right now. But you know what's interesting, by the way, is like a lot of what people, you know, believe to be, obstacles, blockers to doing things outside the norm, like the inclination, whether it's, the launch escape system itself, or just simply the, you know, feasibility of recovery forces, or, you know, putting mass in the trunk. Like I've seen all these things as ideas around the second mission have been floated. It was like, it was only because it wasn't a requirement before. Like some sort of like impassable mountain that you can overcome. Like that's kind of the whole point of a tech development mission too. The IVA suits that we wore on Inspiration 4 were not designed to undertake an EVA. We're building EVA suits. And these are all things that I think, you know, is part of very much the SpaceX way. So, you know, we will solve launch escape system and recovery forces for a non-ISS inclination should we choose to go, you know, somewhere else on a follow-on mission.
So you're saying there's a chance?
Yeah, no, I mean, maybe not necessarily with a polar orb, but I think like when you think of like what comes next, right? Like what is the launch escape system on a Starship?
There's many Reddit a thread about that if you want to get into it.
So I think like, again, just, you know, as we move away from what the vehicle has, you know, safely and successfully done consistently, we can keep doing so in support of ISS missions into these more development missions, you should expect things that were traditionally believed to be like, impassable to be cleared. and one we should all actually be quite enthusiastic about, because maybe it's not Polaris, but somebody else is doing a polar mission 5 years from now. Who knows?
So what is the interaction like when you, or it might not be you, but anyone in particular comes up with a capability that you'd like to work on one of these missions? Does it come up as a topic at one of the meetings at Hawthorne and you start kicking around ways to solve it? What's that flow like for any of these given capabilities?
I would say most of this happens before an announcement takes place. So to give you an idea, I mean, if people saw the Inspiration 4 documentary, things like the, you know, orbital altitude, what we were looking to accomplish on that were worked out before an announcement, before you ever start training to a mission. The same is applicable to Polaris Dawn. And that process is involves quite a lot of healthy debate. And I mean, that's kind of core to SpaceX DNA, is to question the requirements, why we're doing, you know, anything kind of right from the get-go. By the time you work through that mission design and get to an announcement, everyone should generally feel really good that the objectives that have been established are achievable. That doesn't mean there isn't a lot of work that goes into it. There is. But now you're generally in a path where we can start building a training program around this. So like, for example, at the time we announced Polaris Dawn, you know, I think we carefully picked a word, like we endeavor to achieve the highest Earth orbit ever flown. You know, we think we'll go farther than anyone's gone since the last lunar mission. You know, basically signaling, we think we can get to 1400 kilometers. You're kind of hashing that out during mission design. Now, as you build on it, you gain a lot of confidence and you kind of close out some of the, you know, blockers to getting to that. And you, so that's kind of like how like that early sausage making goes, I'd say.
Just was thinking about, we were talking about the Eagles before we started recording, and Pete Conrad was on the Gemini flight that went to 13 whatever kilometers. So Eagles fans only above a certain altitude in Earth orbit.
Oh, we'll see.
Some of the capabilities that you are working on for Polaris Dawn, Starlink was one of those as well, the connectivity aspect. Is that something that just like you'd like to tweet more this time around? What was the specific idea behind Starlink? Is that something SpaceX was really interested in getting on, something that you were?
Oh, I mean, that it's a big objective for SpaceX. I mean, that is very much in the line of, does this help us get to Mars? For sure. Not conclusively staying, but I can't imagine that an armada of starships is going to rely upon TGRIS and ground stations, and it will become completely like impractical, for super long duration spaceflight missions. So Starlink is going to be, you know, the logical way you're going to communicate with starships and maybe, you know, a lunar base, a Martian base at some point in time. So that is really hard. You know, as we've gone through Polaris Dawn's mission design and all the engineering updates we get, as we get closer, I'm like, I hope the documentary crews and such are capturing this, because people are just going to think you just turn the on switch, like flip the switch and just internet's work. And, it's so hard. I mean, the laser links between, you know, two objects going 17,500 miles an hour, like that is hard. And, you know, you've got Draco firings on Dragon that can change its orientation to optimize for, you know, electrical generation and such. And that like can create problems. So it's really just amazing how many talented people are working on really hard problems that from the outside people may not appreciate how challenging they are. And Starlink is certainly one of them.
Yeah. And especially, I don't know if it's going to be active the whole flight, but you're flying under Starlink and then you're going above Starlink. It's not just like you can design for one orbital scenario when you've got such a dynamic mission plan in front of you.
But I mean, it is like, it's so important. I mean, I remember some of the, you know, critiques that, you know, on Inspiration 4 of like, why wasn't there more video on day one and two? And, you know, I don't think people realize, because it was the first private mission, like we didn't have, you know, the same unrestricted tier one access to, you know, national assets like TGRIS the same way every other mission prior to us did. Like we were a step down in priority from every other one. So we had on average about 80% comm coverage over our 3-day mission, which was totally fine. And it was what was anticipated. But like, you have to be able to reduce some of those dependencies on it. It's like it, you know, right now, I mean, you know, or relatively up until recently, you know, the government is essentially, you know, building their airplanes, hiring their pilots, training their pilots, picking their missions, and, you know, building or contracting out the various assets to support it. I don't think that's very scalable if we're trying to talk about, you know, hundreds or thousands of people in space. In fact, like, the way to do it is to bring on other assets that can, you know, create good competitive environments to drive down costs. And that's the whole key for this whole thing of opening it up, is bringing costs down. So I think, like, getting Starlink operational out there, reducing dependency on legacy assets, and bringing down costs, it's like a, you know, kind of part of the bigger vision.
The whole thing was really funny when people were getting hot and bothered about not enough video. I'm like, number one, they don't have to. Like, this is not one of those missions where, like, the taxpayer demands to know what time they're eating their pizza. Like, I don't particularly care. But number two, yeah, like, the logistics of that is just a whole other aspect. But, you know, internet. From Inspiration 4, were there, you know, there's going to be certain lessons about, let's fix the toilet next time, let's do this different. Are there particular lessons that you've learned from that in terms of a mission planning perspective? You know, you just announced earlier today all these science missions that you're doing on board. Axiom 1 that floated the ISS recently notably said that they packed their schedule way too tight. So are there just workload concerns that you've thought about differently this time, or planning things that you've done differently?
Yeah. I mean, frankly, I mean, from Inspiration 4, we didn't have enough. And you know, that was a very important part of our mission. And, you know, we had like a half a dozen, you know, science and research experiments. And I think they got quite a bit out of it. I found it, you know, rather fascinating. It should be a lot more than that. So, I mean, that was, you know, why we kind of intentionally went out and sought a lot more inputs from various educational institutions and such. It's great to look. I mean, having been there, look, it's absolutely fantastic to look out the window and have, you know, such an incredible view that few others have seen. But, you know, you kind of owe your time back. Just for having the privilege of even being in that position right now. So we will still catch plenty of great views. But I think we can ensure we're more, you know, productive, and maximize the value of what we're able to, you know, do on orbit, or maximize the time value of what we're able to accomplish on orbit.
So. Less distracting window this time.
Yeah, for sure.
that matters a little bit. More Twitter, less distracting window. So we'll see how that shakes out in terms of your focus on it. The other aspect that I wanted to dig into on, you talked a lot there about how what you're doing is leaning into a future where there are, you know, an abundance of flights to space, and there's, you know, more people in space than our infrastructure today can handle. I'm curious now, you know, the way that you're preparing for these missions, if you've thought about the preparation side at all, where you're, you know, you were doing fighter jet training and scaring the shit out of Eric Berger recently and doing, you know, very hardcore serious business prep for these missions. Certainly with Inspiration 4, you know, the whole normies to space angle was a big part of that, of like preparing. This one, more serious business, but still a lot of preparation. What do you view preparation like in the future when it is, you know, point-to-point Starship or just more frequent access to space? Like, are we going to get to a point where that preparation is not going to be as necessary? We don't have to go take fighter jet rides to be prepared for it? Or is that something that you're like, I don't know, man, that's, you know, for people 10 or 20 years from now to figure out?
No, I mean, I think about this all the time. I mean, that was kind of my big, you know, feedback coming back from Inspiration 4, you know, where we, you know, did all of our debriefs with all the engineers and such. It was like, you know, I don't think, despite all the training you get on medical and flight physiology, space medicine, I don't think it was really possible for me to fully appreciate how different you feel until you were there. It's kind of like the same thing, even just talking to people about putting, you know, G's on someone here. It's like, well, I've been on roller coasters. It's like, no, it's not the same. And until you, you know, pull 7 G's in like a fighter jet, you can't, you know, pot. And then it's very eye opening. You're like, wow, this is something different than I ever imagined. Well, that's what it's like being in space. And you feel different. And 50% of people feel really bad. I mean, we, you know, 50% of the crew of Inspiration 4 had to be treated with, you know, three different, you know, escalating layers of, of treatment to kind of control space adaptation syndrome. And that's consistent amongst like the most highly screened NASA astronauts, cosmonauts, European Space Agency and such. So I was like, what are you going to do when you put 100 people on a Starship and 50% are feeling really bad and throwing up? And then the other 50% probably aren't appreciating everything that's floating around next to them. But that's why you do all this, right? I mean, I think quite a bit of the research we're taking up on Polaris Dawn directly relate to space adaptation syndrome, neuroocular syndrome, you know, intracranial pressure. There is a lot we're trying to learn to develop countermeasures so that, yeah, it can be that same day, like that, like world we want to get to of it's now boarding flight 55 to the moon and 100 people get in their seats and they're happy and healthy the whole way there. So there's a lot to learn to develop treatments or countermeasures to some of the, you know, things that we just know are problematic about opening up space to lots of people. Now, there is also a vehicle design element to it as well. So, you know, you build something as massive as Starship where, you know, there's no question there's going to be a handful of crew members that have real responsibilities in case something goes wrong. And then everybody else will have, you know, substantially more training than getting on an airline, but basically like this is how you take care of yourself under a you know, a handful of like, you know, low likelihood contingencies or something. See, Dragon isn't built that way. You know, Dragon was built for NASA where there were a lot of, you know, backup and manual capabilities built into the vehicle so you could save your life if something goes wrong. So you can't avoid like you're never going to not train to that if the capability is there. So that's why you have like, you know, call it a 6-month Dragon training timeline. And the EBA and research extended that for us. But when you design a vehicle that doesn't require that and you come up with countermeasures and treatments to prevent, you know, some of the realities we know exist today in, you know, space, you know, in flight physiology that like happens to human beings, then yeah, I think you can cut it down like materially. I don't think that's, you know, necessarily hours, but it's certainly not months.
Yeah. Might not have to climb mountains to go on the flight.
But you know where that like comes in, right? Like that, you know, again, like you, what's very known about Inspiration 4, like, well, there was a broken toilet, but that actually like wasn't apparent to us until after we came back. Like the actual alarm and system failures were much scarier than that. They're the ones that should never go off. And was applicable to NASA's crew too, and as well. So it was, you know, an issue. So you have like a system issue that creates a stressful environment, and then you have two crew members that feel not well at all, right? You don't get to just say like mission's over, time to come home, because that introduces a whole new set of risks. Like hitting, you know, an emergency deorbit profile is a super risky event. So. The idea that you can kind of persevere in a situation that's very uncomfortable now on a number of levels and still be reasonably happy and productive throughout the duration of the mission, that's why you do, you know, the mountain climbing or, you know, the NOLS courses and such that NASA uses.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a ton of sense. And I think it is an aspect of how novel it is at this moment in history, right? I mean, like, you roll the clock back and we were like, what would happen if humans went faster than the sound barrier? I bet they would explode. Like we had crazy theories for what would happen when we started doing more and more aeronautical feats. And then you look 100 years later and it looks kind of silly. So, you know, I feel like there's an aspect where this is just that border of human experience. And as we do more of it with different kinds of people and different types of flights, like that's just the process. This is how this stuff goes, you know, in the same way that how to bring the cost down on anything. It's like, well, books were once for very rich people, and now they're very cheap. So, like, that was a good trajectory. How else can we do that with other things in technology, like cell phones and computers and mattresses? Like, there's everything in history has taken that you know, trajectory. So, if you have that long view, then you know, I think that's why I'm so interested in what you're doing, is that you have this idea to contribute in the ways that you can. And maybe that's a spot to take a minute to talk about that. You're a very entrepreneurial person, you know, by trait, and as we can see from everything that you're involved in. So why is it that for space, you chose this way to contribute to the storyline versus doing another company that is doing something else in space or doing space services? Like, why was this the direction that you felt passionate about?
Well, I think for starters, it's very, it's like impossible to compete with SpaceX. So, you know, like, I do believe that, you know, been an entrepreneur for, I don't know, like 23 years, started my first company. Opportunity is a pretty key ingredient. SpaceX has a monumental lead in this, and they are not slowing down. It's actually like quite extraordinary. Whenever you think about some like really groundbreaking technology that, you know, is just eye-watering and lightning, like there's usually somebody in second place, not that far behind. Smartphone's a good example. iPhone comes out, wow, this is amazing. You know, the Android comes out 6 months later, okay. Apple Pay, Google Pay, whatnot. Like, I mean, you know it pretty well. I mean, it's been 7 years. No one else has landed a rocket on a ship, and they've done it 100 times there over. So I'd say like, you know, it became very clear. And I've been following SpaceX for geez, since like, you know, very relatively early days of the company. So none of this is that surprising. But in my mind, this isn't like a let's try and, you know, compete for the sake of competition. And they've got a winning team. And how can I help? How can I literally do anything, to contribute in a small way to what you're trying to accomplish and the history you're making? And that's really where Inspiration 4 came in. That's where, the Polaris program came along. So that's just where I feel like I can make the most impact. And being able to contribute financially into this, I think, you know, there's a right way for ensuring or trying to generate support across the world of having the right, you know, the right focus that it's not just all about, you know, space. We're not trying to abandon the planet because we've destroyed it. Like, we can make our planet a lot better. And we can do these things because it will be a more interesting world if we can accomplish it. I have a little bit of an aviation aerospace background that, you know, maybe can contribute, in just a small part from a technical perspective too. So that's why this has become my, a big focus area for me.
Your aviation background, I forgot to mention. I feel like I've probably seen you fly in a lot of air shows because I used to go to the Atlantic City Air Show every year. I still do to some extent, but I'm like, man, I remember watching that Black Diamond team. So I feel like you were,
shows, man.
Yeah, you were in there a couple of times. I feel like Scott too, probably, right? He was in the Thunderbird side. Now, all that said about not wanting to start a company in the same way and contribute in a different way, Polaris program is certainly capturing some expertise internally in the team that you've got and the things that you're taking on. We're in this era where there's a lot of different companies starting their own private astronaut training centers. You know, like there's a ton of them now with all the space station stuff coming online. Do you see that as any way that the Polaris program might roll out in the future where maybe beyond that third flight, you've got a different tact on how do you now share this expertise? Or do you feel like once that third flight happens, you're going to say, okay, you know, now what? What is the stuff before us, given where we're at that point in the industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so much more likely that, and I would say it's kind of unlikely, but I think it's more likely that there would be a fourth, you know, Polaris mission than trying to pivot, you know, what we've assembled here with Polaris into some sort of commercial entity. It's just not what we're setting out to accomplish. So.
So the polar mission is still a chance. I'm going to keep pushing for this. If you had a fourth mission, it is going to ruin the other fun theory that we've been referring to the Polaris missions in the way that the foundation guys are named, with the Polaris Dawn, Day, and Dusk, though. That's a little darker connotation than we want for the final one.
No, you'd have to have a new kind of naming convention for subsequent missions, which never happens.
I'm running out of questions here. It's been really cool to pick your brain on this stuff. I'm curious, just mentioning future Starship flights, you know, we saw Dennis Tito and this announcement last week that he's back in the space tourism headlines, which is cool. There's Dear Moon, obviously, out there. You know, you've had interactions with the NASA side crews on flying Dragon flights and all that. Are there similar interactions going on the Starship side as well? And obviously, the Polaris mission is the first Starship flight, so those are going to be more likely to learn from you versus the other way around. But is that more of a bigger collaboration with the Starship team overall?
Well, I mean, in terms of like, we do interact with NASA astronauts pretty frequently because we basically share the same training center and simulators. So you see each other there and there's kind of always mutual interest in, you know, mission objectives and such. But, you know, on Starship, it's, everybody is just so focused on getting to orbit. Like that's, you know, it, the organization is very singularly focused in a great direction on that. So there's not a lot of, you know, you could be at, you could be having casual conversations over dinner and you know, throw out some questions on like how something hypothetically might be from like a habitability perspective, but it really is very focused on let's just get to orbit right now. And then we'll go from there.
They're like, man, we're still figuring out the outside. We're not talking about the inside yet. The last bit that I thought was interesting to pick your brain on is things that you're interested in outside of the human spaceflight stuff. Obviously Hubble is an aspect to that, right? We've heard about this study that's going on with reboosting Hubble, but are there other things within the space industry that you're keeping an eye on and either just interested on and in kind of an enthusiast perspective or something that you might find interesting in the near future?
Well, I mean, I'm pretty focused on, I think, essentially the same KPI that Elon often references, which is just the cost to accelerate mass to orbit. Because as that continues to come down, it's just really impossible to anticipate everything that could come from it. I mean, I use the example all the time, but you know, cell phones in the 1980s and car phones and rich Wall Street guys, and you could never imagine in my mind how many multi-billion dollar, you know, companies have emerged simply to provide like an app on a cell, not even the operating system, not making the phone, not the network. In fact, some of the infrastructure players are like, you know, the least interesting. like you just couldn't possibly, you know, anticipate that or all the utility that has essentially come from it. You know, like even our insights into what's going on in conflicts like in Ukraine or, you know, other humanitarian or disaster issues from storms and what, like all this evolved from something that we would have like, you know, stuck our nose up to at one point, you know, 40 years ago. So I don't even want to begin with predictions, you know, like what I think could be the most interesting or compelling coming from it, other than just simply if Starship succeeds, it just opens up so much in the realm of possibility. It's just exciting. And it's not like all like, I mean, naturally I'm like very interested in human spaceflight. You know, that's a focus of ours. I'm like incredibly interested in what could be done when you have basically like a prefab, very low cost rocket that you could mount sensors, telescopes, turn into probes, maybe dock like 50 of them and literally create a floating city. I don't know. I mean, there's just so much in the realm of possible now.
The question I'll leave you with, I'm just trying to get ahead of the gatekeepering that's going to happen. Cause that was a thing that, oh, well they went this high, they didn't go that high. And you know, this thing was higher than that thing. And all of the gatekeeping of firsts, the EVA is going to be one that's going to attract this, right? Where whoever the two are that go out, the other two are still sitting in spacecraft that has been vented to vacuum. So in my book, everyone is doing an EVA if you're 100%. In a spacesuit. So I just want you on the record that this everyone's doing an EVA.
I actually think that I think it fits within even a NASA definition. My understanding is the Gemini and Apollo crew members that vented their vehicles down to vacuum, that everyone was given credit for an EVA. Some might call like a stand up. But
yeah.
Look, they're taking all the same risks.
I would be no more comfortable if I'm sitting in a suit or floating on a tether. So
yeah, everybody is like, you all have to be 100% bought off and believe that, you know, the EVA is worth the risk that we stand to gain quite a bit from it. It is without question, like the most highest risk element to our mission objectives. But and just also like we're not, like I think sometimes people get like really hung up with all the firsts on that. Like we're not trying to like stack a list on some of these things. Like from our perspective, like altitude wise, like you're going there to learn a lot. You're taking a lot of science experiments from like, you know, a human side of the whole thing. Like we want to be able to go to the Mars and back and not die of cancer along the way. You know, we want to build our vehicles to, you know, be robust against radiation hits without putting like, you know, surrounding them with water or lead or some other, you know, costly or impractical solution, right? So you're going as high as you need to learn from that. And then you're coming down. And like to us, it didn't matter, you know, 14 or 1500. We just knew there was a particular zone that you're going to want to be at on this. So
yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was chosen before for a reason. Like that's not a random number they picked out of the book. So
yeah, you don't really want to be much higher into the belts if you can avoid it.
So. Yeah, you're less invested in the first than many people on the interwebs. So I'm just trying to get ahead of the gatekeeping that's heading your way in the near future. So Jared, thank you so much for this. This was really cool to hang out, and best of luck with the remaining training. And I'm sure we'll talk sometime between now and the flight as well. So hope to catch up with you, and maybe we'll see it at an Eagles game or something like that.
Yeah, sounds good. Enjoy the conversation with the rest of the crew. They're all like immensely talented, awesome individuals. I'm really lucky to get to go to space with them.
So. Yeah, I'm excited. It feels like we're going to have the whole story now. We talked a lot about the founding and the inspiration behind it and all that. So to dig into what they've been working on will be really cool as well. So thanks again.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks. Take care.
Thanks again to Jared for the conversation. It was really cool to sit down and talk. He's just such a down-to-earth guy and very easygoing to talk to, so really cool. Thanks to him and the Polaris program team overall for making this thing possible. And as I mentioned, we'll be talking with the rest of the crew in the near future, so very cool to have this kind of access to the crew of Polaris Dawn, and I'm excited to watch them get closer to the launch pad. If you like these shows, you got to head over to mainenginecutoff.com/support and join up there. This is a 100% listener-funded show. So if you like what you're listening to, if you like these kind of shows, if you like my ability to talk to people like Jared Isaacman, head over to support. Make this something that keeps happening because your support is how I do all of this. It's how I traveled to Astrobotic last week. It's how I've got enough credibility at this point, to be honest, to book guests like this. So if you like this, ManageToCutOff.com/support. Join the crew there. There are 884 of you supporting the show every single month. I'm so thankful for everything that you're doing there, including the 43 executive producers who made this episode possible. Thanks to Simon, Chris, Pat, Matt, George, Ryan, Donald, Lee, Chris, Warren, Bob, Russell, Moritz, Joel, Jan, David, Eunice, Rob, Tim Dodd, the Everdashnaut, Frank, Julian, Lars from Agile Space, Matt, the Astrogators at SEE, Chris, Aegis Trade Law, Fred, Haymonth, Dawn Aerospace, Andrew, Harrison, Benjamin, Small Spark Space Systems, Tyler, Sean, and Daniel Hart, and 7 anonymous executive producers. Thank you all so much for the support, for making this possible. If you want to head over there, you can get Miko Headlines in Your Life, which is a whole nother podcast that I do every single week. I run through all the stories that happened in space that week, everything you need to stay up on. It's a great way to support the show and get more podcasts in your life, more of me in your ears, if that's what you like. So head over there. Thank you so much for all the support that you're giving me. And with that, that's all I've got for you today. So if you've got any questions or thoughts, hit me up on email, anthony@managingcutoff.com, or on Twitter @wehavemiko. And until next time, I'll talk to you soon.